The Sunshine State turned red for Donald Trump, propelling him to the White House. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Matthew Petty from WMFE in Orlando. Record voter turnout in South Florida and the Democratic votes that came were not enough to hold off a surge of voters for Trump almost everywhere else.
This is Decision Florida from WLRN in Miami and Florida Public Broadcasting. On Tuesday, Florida delivered for Donald Trump, confounding the Clinton campaign, which had outspent and outnumbered Trump with its ground game.
The Hispanic vote did not pour its support behind Clinton, and some were not put off by Trump's rhetoric around immigration. Instead, the economic and strong on crime and trade messages resonated with Florida voters.
We talk with the head of Hispanic outreach for national Republicans, as well as state party officials. Call us 305-995-1800. Use the hashtag DecisionFlorida on Twitter. It's next. From WLRN Public Media in Miami and Florida Public Radio, this is Decision Florida. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Matthew Petty from WMFE in Orlando. Up until a couple of weeks ago, Juan Tomas Sanchez was undecided who he'd vote for president. Sanchez is retired now. He was an engineer who came to Florida from Cuba in the 1960s when he was 18. Leading up to Election Day, Sanchez began to hear something he liked from Donald Trump on education and addressing America's inner-city challenges.
And I said, yeah, I'm looking at two of the biggest problems that, in my mind, this nation has. You know, the problems in the inner cities and the problem of education. So I started to warm up to the idea of liking Donald Trump, but more as a protest vote, because I was sure, like everybody else, that he would never win.
But Trump did win. Trump won Florida with the help of Sanchez. Sanchez was part of the 36% of Latinos in Florida who voted for Donald Trump on Tuesday, according to exit polling by Florida International University, and part of the 30% of Latinos nationwide that went for Trump. That's more than voted for Mitt Romney 4 years ago. Now, Matthew, that losing effort led the Republican National Committee at the time to say, quote, it is imperative that the RNC changes how it engages with Hispanic communities, end quote.
Well, Helen Aguirre-Ferre leads the Republican Hispanic Strategy Group. She's the director of Hispanic Communications for the Republican National Committee, and she joins us now from Washington, D.C. Helen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
So let me ask first about the percentage of Latino voters who went for Trump in Florida. 36%, was that kind of on par with what you expected?
Well, we were definitely looking to have a minimum of 30% in order to feel comfortable. But as we traveled around the state and spoke to voters and continued with our voter engagement program, it was pretty clear that there was a growing number of Hispanic voters who were really unhappy with the economy, with the prospects for the future, with the issue of school choice, but also Hispanic evangelicals were really vocal about their concern for the Supreme Court, for religious liberties, and very definitely being pro-life people of faith. They really were very much more active this time around than we saw in 2012.
Was your part of your voter engagement strategy in Florida, at least, and elsewhere in the country, was it also kind of having to walk back a little bit of what we heard from Donald Trump on the campaign trail?
Well, certainly, you know, there are some things that as the Republican National Committee was very clear of where we stood on important and significant issues, but we've basically really focused on the areas of great concern. And there were a couple of things where, of course, you know, we're not going to defend what, you know, we can't, but there were so many other points where we were totally coinciding and working very much toward, and that had to do with the issue of, you know, making government accountable. There was no question that as you toured the country, there is this growing number of American voters who were saying, you know what, we are tired of the establishment class, the political class, that, you know, this status quo that is great for keeping themselves and their friends in power, as they would see it, and doing very little to help the disaffected, hardworking families who used to be able to save and can barely make it month to month, paying rent and groceries, much less education. So when I was listening to your previous package and I was listening to that voter from the Orlando area, mm-hmm. there were two points that he mentioned. He mentioned jobs and economy, which poll after poll after poll suggested was the number one concern, but also education. 68% of Hispanics on both sides of the aisle support school choice. And that was an issue that Donald Trump kept speaking about and was campaigning hard on, because as a businessman, he knows that it begins with a good education and jobs follow talent. So that was very important. And I think, you know, it was an area where Democrats, who are very supportive of teachers' unions, you know, missed the boat and just weren't listening. Paul Ryan, Speaker Ryan, was absolutely right when he said President-elect Donald Trump heard what others were unable to hear. And that's where people saying, we want change.
Helen, it's Tom Hudson. Thanks for joining us. Nice to talk to you. Speaking of listening, 4 years ago, as you're well aware, that so-called RNC autopsy report, the Growth and Opportunity Project that grew out of Mitt Romney's loss and record low support that was received on the part of Governor Romney from Hispanics. It said, quote, if Hispanics think that we do not want them here, meaning in the United States, they will close their ears to our policies. What we heard, what voters heard from President-elect Trump during the campaign was build a wall in Mexico, enforce current immigration, resume and perhaps pick up even deportation, which was a message to certain immigrants that the Republican Party, or at least the Republican nominee, may not want them here. But yet at least 36% of them in Florida, 30% nationwide, look beyond it.
Well, actually, what you see, so we look, you know, nationwide, and we see that, you know, initially we know that we've definitely improved on Governor Romney's numbers, but what they were also hearing, and these are immigrant Hispanic voters, right? So we're talking about, listen, we believe in immigration, but it needs to be legal immigration, Tom. So, you know, there used to be a time where, you know, we would be able to have a conversation about immigration where we were stressing the need to have immigration reform, because we need to ensure that legal immigration is made easier and illegal immigration is harder. Right now we do it the other way around, and then we're surprised by the outcomes. So you begin with border security, because you can never have immigration reform, meaningful of immigration reform, if you really don't secure your border first to the best of the ability. Call it a fence, which is what we have right now. Call it a wall, whatever you want. A physical barrier has always been a component and a part of immigration.
So
border, you know, strong border security is good, by the way. Not only is it a sovereign national right, but it's good for the United States, and it's also good for Mexico.
And the sovereign right was the issue that obviously President-elect Trump was making that argument and resonated certainly with his supporters. Let me ask you, beyond that border security, President-elect Trump yesterday in meeting with Capitol Hill leaders said that immigration and border security are among his top issues. Let's move beyond border security and talk about immigration. Will he cancel President Obama's executive action deferring deportation of people who were brought to the United States illegally as children?
I can tell you that this is what President-elect Trump has said, and that he's going to start to work on border security as his first issue. And so here you see a big change when it comes to immigration that I think has been largely overlooked. You know, some years back, there was this big debate about immigration reform, but people don't realize that even in Congress, there was this huge discussion as to whether to do it in a comprehensive fashion or to do it piecemeal. So here there's a clear indication that we're going to start piecemeal, and it's going to begin with border security.
But beyond that,
number two, there's a focus on sanctuary cities and making sure
cities such as Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco,
making sure that they comply with federal law. Now, if they don't want to comply with federal law, there will be repercussions to those sanctuary cities, and
financial repercussions.
Financial, you know, federal funding and so on and
so forth. But what about the deferred action, executive actions that President Obama
has made?
So he has
said number three when it comes to those who are here illegally. Number one, if you are a criminal without legal documentation, you will be deported. If you have not committed a crime, and by the way, being here without proper documentation is a civil penalty. It's not a felony. If you have not committed a felony, a crime, then you will not be the target of deportation, and you that issue will be decided by Congress and with leadership from, coming from the White House further down the road.
So that sounds like for those children, adults now, but children who are brought here illegally who have not committed crimes in the United States, that any deportation risk to them would be deferred under President-elect
Trump. This is what he has said, that that's not going to be the focus by any stretch of the imagination. It's not going to be, there aren't going to be any raids, and there's not going to be a movement to deport 11, 15, 8, whatever the number of the undocumented are. We don't even know. Yeah. But that's not going to be a focus.
Helen Aguirre-Ferreira is Matthew Pitty again from WMFE. How do you square that with all of those voters who went to those rallies, heard Mr. Trump talking about what he was going to do, build the wall, you know, deport the illegal immigrants? How do you square what you're saying now, which seems like a lot more of a nuanced position, with what his supporters, a lot of them, are expecting him to do?
Well, actually, he's been saying this at his rallies in the last couple of months. And so it's not something that he said in the last 48 hours. He has said that that's going to be his focus. Now, he is going to enforce what current immigration law there is today. And the current deportations, we have not stopped in these last 7.5 years of the Obama administration. We have not stopped deporting.
That's right.
Those
yeah.
who are here illegally.
Yeah. 2012 was a record deportation year under the Obama
yeah.
administration, record
so,
for the United States.
So the laws on the books are going to be followed as they stand today. But what he is saying is that there isn't going to be a concerted effort to grow further than what we have today at this point. This is what he has said, and he has said it publicly. Oh, Lord, I mean, I've been hearing it for the last couple of months at public rallies.
Okay, so, you know, when you've been hearing this talk at public rallies, it seems like there's a little bit of squishiness there. What about this wall? When you're talking just now, it sounds like it's more of a kind of a metaphysical wall in some way, a look at the law rather than the physical barrier, fence, if you will.
No, there's going to be a physical barrier. We have one right now. It's a fence. And so, it's, you know, call it a fence, call it a wall, you know, where we have a physical barrier. You can't have it the entire length of it, unless, of course, you want to get into private property and go through eminent domain procedures, or there's water. But where we do have a fence right now, that there are holes through it, it's in some areas very much in tatters. I mean, you know, you replace it and you build and you put a wall instead, and you make it higher, you make it as thick as you want, whatever you want. But we do have currently a physical barrier in part of our border, and so that will be put in.
Helen Frey from Miami, but with the Republican National Committee, with us from Washington. Helen, nice to catch up, and congratulations to the committee on its win.
Thank you so very much. I'm so appreciative of the invitation to be here and to be able to participate.
You got it. We got plenty more to come. We'll be speaking with the chairman of the Florida Republican Party next. This is Decision Florida from Florida Public Radio.
Public Radio. This is Decision Florida. I'm Matthew Pitty with WMFE in Orlando.
And I'm Tom Hudson with WLRN in Miami. Thanks for listening this week. Donald Trump won 119,489 more votes in Florida than Hillary Clinton. Now, Clinton won big in South Florida. She had more than a 500,000 vote margin in Palm Beach County, Broward County, and Miami-Dade County alone, Matthew. She also won in Hillsborough, home to Tampa, and in Orange County, home to Orlando, and in Tallahassee. But everywhere else in the state of Florida, panhandle of the peninsula, the election map was red. And it was a deep red, helping give Trump Florida's 29 electoral college votes and eventually, obviously, the White House. Andy Haroldson in Miami voted for Trump.
I'm glad that he won. I'm excited that Donald Trump won, because he represents, to me, a change. And so I'm kind of interested to see what's going to come next. He's not a career politician. He's a businessman. He's going to look at things more pragmatically than a career politician would.
What's the change that you are looking forward to with the Trump administration? Join Decision Florida here today, 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800, or on social media, send us a tweet, use the hashtag Decision Florida.
Well, Blaise Ingolia helped deliver Florida for Donald Trump. He's the chairman of the Republican Party of Florida. He joins us now by phone. Thank you so much for joining us, Blaise.
My pleasure.
So tell us about the outcome of the election and the way Florida voted. I mean, what does it tell you about the makeup of the Florida GOP from here on out?
Well, the one thing I would say about the makeup of Florida is, and I have always said, that we are not a purple state. We are a red state that just happened to lose the last two presidential elections. If you look at our elected officials from the cabinet, the governor's office, all the way down to our state legislator, our state senate, our state representatives, and then all the way down to city councils and county commissions, we have a bunch of Republicans that are elected. We just did a poor job in years past with getting out the vote and getting our messaging out. So that's what you've seen during this election, was a comprehensive, very strong ground game. Even though other people said that the ground game was non-existent, it was. They really just weren't paying attention to what we were doing, and we're just very happy that we delivered a resounding win.
So the strategy of kind of skipping the cities with those concentration of Democratic voters were and going for the suburbs, that was the way to go. But I'm wondering about...
I wouldn't say that, because if you look at Pinellas County, we were up 10,000 votes in Pinellas County. Yes, there are Democrat strongholds in the state, like Broward County, Palm Beach, and Miami. But we did a very good job. Look at the I-4 corridor. We won in the I-4 corridor, and that's important.
Except for Orange County.
For
Orange County. Blaise, it's Tom Hudson. Thanks for joining us, Tom, here statewide. Who were the Republicans in Florida that put Trump over the top, that put him with that almost 120,000 vote margin of victory?
I can put them all in one basket, and it's not a basket of deplorables. It is a basket of people who are just frustrated with their federal government beyond belief. And it's not just frustration at the federal government, it's not just frustration with Democrats and Democratic policies, but it was also frustration, quite frankly, with a lot of Republicans. It's one of the reasons why you've seen Donald Trump beat 16, 17 people in a primary, is that people said, okay, we've had enough with what's going on at Washington, D.C., it was a referendum against the status quo. But also, if you look at the results, this was also a mandate. It was a mandate for Republicans to govern the way they campaign and do what they say they are going to do. And that's the people who came out in mass this Tuesday, and that's why we have these election results.
As you dig down to some of the exit polls and some of the results here, Blaise, and I know you'll spend a lot of time with this data for Florida Republicans, give us a sense of new voter turnout, of what you have called low propensity voters, in other words, voters who have been registered but maybe didn't vote 4 years ago or 8 years ago, and high propensity voters, voters that show up every 4 years to vote.
Sure, and I will dovetail that into the reasons why I had predicted that Trump was going to win and how he was going to win. What we had seen...
That prediction, by the way, Blaise, had nothing to do with you being the chairman of Florida Republicans, did it?
No, it was a data. It was okay. A data prediction. It was based upon the data, and what I'm going to tell you right now is what I had seen in the data and why I knew what everyone else was saying on TV and all the pundits and all the pollsters were wrong, because the data was telling a different story. So when you look at propensities of voters, just for the listeners, we rank them. We rank them with new voters, and then we rank them how many times they vote out of the last four elections. So a 3 out of 4 voter and a 4 out of 4 voter are what you term the super voters. Those are the people who are definitely going to come out. Then you have a 0 of 4, a 1 of 4, and a 2 of 4. Up until the last day, which was Monday, the day before Election Day, Republicans, we were beating Democrats in the percentage of new voters that were coming out. Actually, excuse me, we were tied with new voters, and we were tied with 2 of 4 voters. 1 of 4 voters and 0 of 4 voters, we were beating the Democrats on the percentage of those voters coming out. Now, the Democrats were actually beating us up until the last day on high propensity voters, the super voters, the 3 of 4s and the 4 of 4s. They did such a good job with that they didn't leave themselves any voters for Election Day. In fact, 73% of all of the 4 of 4 voters had voted before Election Day. So when I was looking at the data, I was saying, Well, come Election Day, we had almost 200,000 more 404 voters than they had. So it was a race. So, it was a race between our high propensity voters against their low propensity voters, and we were turning out a higher percentage of low propensity voters than they were.
The super Republican voters showing up on Election Day is what Blaise Ingolia, chairman of the Republican Party of Florida, is crediting for that win.
We're going to go to the phones now. We've got Keanu calling from Pembroke Pines. Keanu, you're on the air. What are your thoughts on this Trump win?
I thought the Trump was a good win. I voted for Trump. Mm-hmm. I think he's going to do good for the economy.
What specifically do you want to see him do? I mean, what are you looking at in your neck of the woods, and what do you think he can help you with?
Well, I think I want him to get marijuana legalized across the board. I think it'll be good for the government, for taxes.
Similar to what they've done in other states around the country?
Yeah. I think if he could legalize it across the board, it would be good for the government, the tax money from that, to help, because I see he wants to lower taxes. He wants to cut taxes.
You know? Keanu, we hear you. Thanks for calling in. Blaise, let me put that to you. I mean, what do you think a Trump presidency means for Florida, if not specifically with regard to marijuana legalization? But if you look at some of the other economic aspects, can you see some smooth sailing there for a Trump administration, or does it lead to some kind of hiccups for things like agriculture and the ports here in the Sunshine State?
Well, I think the Sunshine State, the Florida, is going to benefit from a robust economy and an economy in which the federal government is getting off of our back. The problem with the federal government is that they interject themselves in free markets, and there's too much crony capitalism, and there's too much dictation of what the market should and should not do. It is a system where a few are picking the winners and losers, and I think what you're going to see with a Donald Trump presidency, but remember, it's not just his presidency, it's having the House and the Senate also. So now we have three branches of government. So if you go back to 2008, when Barack Obama got elected, they had all three branches of government, and we had the biggest, most expensive expansion of the regulatory state that this nation has ever seen. And ever since then, the economy has not grown. It has been anemic. What I think Mr. Trump is going to do, now President-elect Trump is going to do, is take a look at these regulatory schemes and start to dial back some of these. And first and foremost is repealing Obamacare. You will see prices go down, but we have 2 years now. We have 2 years to prove to the American people that our policies are better than what the Democrats are offering.
Blaise, let me follow up on that. Let me follow up on health care. As you know, Florida is home to the greatest number of Americans who have health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. More than 1 million Floridians are insured today than prior to the Affordable Care Act. Health costs continue to go up, not only for those that are on the exchange, but also in the small group plan and the large group plan and other off-exchange plans. Are you saying that as the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress move forward to repeal Affordable Care Act, that the premium prices of health coverage in Florida will decrease?
Yes, because what we're going to see is more free market competition. It's not just going to be good enough to just repeal Obamacare. We have to replace it with something that will work for the American people. But look, one of the reasons why healthcare premiums are going up right now is because of government intervention. People really have to realize that government equals inflation. The more government involvement you have, the higher the prices. It is no wonder why the things that we all complain about the most as Americans on how high these prices are, if you think about it, what do we complain about? We complain about the cost of education. We complain about the cost of housing, the cost of health care, the cost of insurance. These are the industries that are the most heavily regulated, and every year we see these price increases.
Yeah, and Blaise, when it comes to health care, you know, I just want to stay focused on that. It is greatly regulated at the state level. Certainly there are federal regulations, and the largest one is obviously the Affordable Care Act, but it is up to state regulators. The state regulators are the ones that have to approve or disapprove of premium increases in coverage and make sure that insurance companies have financial reserves in store to be able to cover the claims. And so when you're talking about a more of an open marketplace for health coverage, in Florida. How much of that is going to come from Washington and a Trump administration versus from Tallahassee and the Republican majority that that's going to be in store this spring?
What I think you're going to see is what we should have in any market, especially if you're going to have governments sort of involved, and that is 50 factories of thinking and innovation, and that is the states. What I think and what I hope we're going to see is we're going to see 50 states coming up with their own ways to push down costs, and then other states are going to replicate which states are doing the best. And when you have a federal government that mandates and dictates how all 50 states have to, what they have to do in terms of the regulatory scheme, there's no leeway.
The federal government tells the states what they need to do when it comes to individual health care. It doesn't tell the states what to do with small group health care and health care that 40% of Floridians get, which is through an employer.
Yeah, but one of the reasons why the costs are so high is because of federal mandates.
And you
still have to deal with federal mandates. In fact, if we want to do something on the state level, we have to go to HHS most likely for a waiver.
Health and Human Services, yeah. Blazin Golia, the chairman of the Republican Party of Florida, you can join the conversation 305-995-1800 or on social media. Use the hashtag Decision Florida. You are listening to Decision Florida from WLRN Miami. This is Florida Public Radio.
Blazin Golia, let me just come back to kind of what the Florida Republican Party looks like from here on out. Now, I want to quote from something from Max Stepanovich. He wrote that Trump is a Republican only in the same sense that the Visigoths who sacked Rome were Romans. But does Donald Trump's success suggest the party itself is on the verge of some kind of cataclysmic upheaval or change?
No, I think it's going to be quite the opposite. I think what you're going to see is on the verge of a revolution. And within the Republican Party, and an expansion, quite frankly, of the base. Look, there was nothing more important to a lot of Republicans than to make sure that we had a Supreme Court that was conservative, handing down conservative decisions. And I think that's the first thing you're going to see. And the second thing that you're going to see is you're going to see within 2 years, you're going to see policy decisions that are going to be made. Because remember, Donald Trump is not a dictator. Donald Trump is one portion of a government that is cut into thirds. He has to work with Congress. He has to work with the Senate. He has to work with the House of Representatives. And there is going to be thoughtful discussion, policy discussion, substantial discussion about what we can do in order to get this nation back on track. And if we do our job, and if we do it right, at the end of 2 years, we're going to get rewarded with more people getting elected to the House of Representatives. We're going to get more people elected to the U.S. Senate. Now, let's not forget that there are, I want to say, three times as many Democrats up for re-election in the U.S. Senate than Republicans in 2 years. And once people start realizing that for 8 years we were sold on plans, on public policy plans that really didn't work for everyone, and the reason that the richer were getting richer in this country was because of anti-competitive practices, quite frankly, big government policies. I think the party and I think this nation is going to be in a better place.
I'm going to take a call now from David in Miami. David, you're on the air. What are your thoughts on this Donald Trump victory as far as Florida goes?
Well, as far as Florida goes and as far as the rest of the nation goes, I think this is going to be great for business, especially big businesses. Mr. Blaze Angolia there was saying that the problem was too much government intervention in our lives. Well, now we're going to have something really great. We're going to have corporate intervention in our lives. We're going to have the corporations deciding everything, because your guest and his fellow travelers are going to have the whole government in their hands, and it is going to be impossible for a regular person to come through his full potential under the new dystopian corporate states of America.
All right, David, let's put that to the chairman of the Republican Party. How do you respond to
that? I would love
clearly
to address that.
Go ahead.
I would love to address that. Because, look, if you notice, back in 2008 when Barack Obama took over, when he had a Democrat House and a Democrat Senate, they pushed more regulations, more major regulations on the U.S. economy and small businesses and regular people than we have ever seen in the history of the Republic. But the most amazing thing happened when that happened. So we had seen higher regulations, higher taxes, but if you notice, what we've seen was the Dow and the S&P 500 and the Russell Index, they grew, they had highs after highs. The stock market grew and kept on breaking records. The reason why it broke records is because of big government and a regulatory state. Let me explain. When you add a complex when you add to a regulatory state, who do you think has the consultants, the lobbyists, the accountants, the lawyers to navigate all of that? It's big business. So every time you add more regulations and more complexity to the regulatory state, the one who benefits the most is big business, the corporations. The way to take the money out of the corporations and to have the big corporations and to help everybody is to make it fairer, to make it easier to navigate, and that comes with deregulation in certain industries. So I love hearing the argument about how you know, that the large corporations are going to be big under under deregulation. It's actually opposite. So every time somebody asks that question, I say, when was the last time you seen a mom and pop pharmacy open up on your street corner? You don't. Because they're all the big chains, because they know how to get it done.
Blaise,
the little guy doesn't.
We'll leave it there. He's the chairman of the Republican Party of Florida, Blaise Ingolia, joining us here on Decision Florida. We've got more to come, including your phone calls, 305-995-1800. You're listening to Decision Florida from WLRN Miami. This is Florida Public Radio. From WLRN Public Media in Miami and Florida Public Radio, this is Decision Florida. Thanks for listening again this week. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Matthew Petty from WMFE in Orlando. Well, Florida did not turn blue as Democrats had hoped for in the weeks leading up to Election Day. It seemed that hardly a few days went by without Secretary Clinton, her running mate, her husband, or President Barack Obama visiting the state to drum up support. Ellen Walker from Broward County never wavered in her support for the candidate. What did she think of Tuesday's results?
I was in shock. I was in shock. He did everything wrong. He didn't follow any rules. He didn't have a ground game the day before. He insulted people. He made tons of mistakes. And so he kept on plugging along, and he won.
We want to hear from you. Tell us how you voted on Tuesday night and why. What were you hoping for and what are your hopes now? We're at 305-995-1800. That's 305-995-1800. You can also reach out to us on social media using the hashtag DecisionFlorida.
Scott Arsenault is back with us. He's the executive director of the Florida Democratic Party, with us from our sister station in Jacksonville, WJCT. Scott, welcome back to Decision Florida.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on again. Appreciate it.
You were with us 10 weeks ago on our first program. Here we are on Veterans Day. You called this a 1% state in Florida. It was a 1.2% margin of victory for Donald Trump over your candidate, Secretary Clinton. What happened?
Well, you're right. It was a very close election, decided by about 119,000 votes. Donald Trump getting just 49%. Yeah, I think, first of all, I know you had Blaise on earlier.
Yeah.
I listened to some of his comments, and I think we have to give credit to him and to Susie Wiles. They ran a great race.
She was the head of the Trump campaign in Florida.
Correct, and I think they obviously did a very good job, and we have to give credit to them for the race that they ran. It was a very tough race. We were obviously disappointed with Tuesday night, but we were proud of our candidate and proud of the race we run and all of our volunteers and the work that they did.
So who didn't turn out? Who was missing that you needed to reach out to or that you thought you had in the bag and just didn't show up on Tuesday night?
Well, I mean, the thing about this election, we had a record turnout vote-wise. I mean, you're aware we had about 9.3 million votes cast. I mean, this is one of those elections where I think everybody turned out. Mm-hmm. We had a record turnout for us. We were obviously concentrated on South Florida a great deal, in Orange County and Duval County, in our big cities. We did really well there, but where we didn't do well, where we obviously didn't get our message out strong enough, where we didn't do enough hard work, was really in those suburban, exurban counties around Tampa, like Pasco and Polk and Manatee and places like Volusia County, Flagler, where we did poorly, and clearly our message did not resonate there.
Democrat voter registration statewide, Scott, is 327,000 more than Republicans. Secretary Clinton lost by about 120,000 votes. So when you say everybody showed up, did Democrats vote Republican at the top of the ticket?
Well, no. I think the answer to that is you have to look at the growing MPA vote here in Florida. We won't know, obviously, until we get the final data, but yeah. I think in this election, MPAs will have been a much higher proportion of the electorate than they were in 12 or certainly were in 8. I think what we now know days after is that a lot of those folks who are independent or MPA voters voted for Mr. Trump. I think that was clear, and particularly in some of those counties that I mentioned, like Pasco, Hernando, mm-hmm. that area around Tampa. I think that's what made the difference.
Blazing Golia, the chairman of the Republican Party of Florida, said that the message that Floridians sent was that they're frustrated with the federal government beyond belief. Is that the message you heard on Tuesday night, Wednesday morning?
No, that's not the message I think we heard at all. I think clearly, though, people did want change. That, you know, what that change means, I think we won't know. I think we'll know later on, but I think clearly this was a change election. We ran very much with the president, and I believe that was the right thing to do. I believe in there's a lot of the great things that Barack Obama has done. We were right to run on them, but at the end of the day, folks were still had some fear. They wanted to see some change, and that's what they voted for.
Going to go to the phones now. We've got Char calling from Pompano Beach. Char, you're on the air.
I'm calling from Pompano Beach, but I live in Tarpon Springs in Pinellas. Mm-hmm. And my husband and I are non-party affiliated, and we have not voted in any of the elections since we've been married for 12 years. And we both felt compelled to vote for President-elect Trump.
And why? What about his message resonated with you?
We trusted him. We looked at interviews from when he wasn't running for president. So we looked at all sorts of different things. And in the end, it was just like, you know what? We trust him. And so we decided we're going to vote and we're going to vote for him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thanks for your call.
Scott Arsenault, when you hear a voter like Char, one of those low propensity voters, as described by your Republican colleague about 20 minutes ago on our program, in other words, somebody who hasn't voted in previous presidential elections in the previous four, the Trump message of trust resonated with her. What do you take away as the head of among the heads of the Democratic Party in Florida?
Well, that's certainly disappointing to hear. I mean, we clearly didn't do a good enough job to get our message out to folks like her about Mr. Trump and his record, and we certainly tried really hard on that. And we didn't do a good enough job talking about a positive vision on our end with Secretary Clinton. I think we could have done more. We clearly should have done more. So voters like that would know what to expect both from Donald Trump and from Secretary Clinton, and that's something that we should have done better.
When we had you on this program, Scott, 10 weeks ago, we talked a lot about strategy and the Clinton ground game in Florida and a traditional strategy. Candidate Trump, arguably at first, may have had an untraditional strategy, although his folks had said they had a ground game and there was a lot of traditional things happening, but obviously an untraditional candidate. Does this change the ground rules of a big national campaign and how it runs in Florida?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I think the Trump folks clearly had an untraditional strategy, but when it came to Election Day, I think they had a very traditional strategy. They clearly did a very good job on Election Day to get out their votes, and I think that showed on November 8th. We had a strategy that was very much focused on vote by mail and early vote, and I think our strategy in some ways really worked. We got 83,000 more votes than Barack Obama in Miami-Dade County alone, yeah, with a higher turnout and more votes. Same thing for Broward, about 37,000 additional votes. Same thing in Orange. Secretary Clinton did better in Duval County than any presidential candidate in a couple of generations. So a lot of the tactics we employed worked. And I think on the counterpoint, Blaze, a lot of the tactics that Blaze employed also worked. Again, I think it showed they had a traditional election day strategy, which they implemented. We had a very good early vote strategy, which we implemented. And it came down to that 49-47 that we live in here in Florida.
I'm going to go to Mike now in Fort Lauderdale. Mike, you're on the air.
Sure, thanks. I'm in Fort Lauderdale living, but I voted in Pinellas County.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a white male, 56, retired, and I think I feel like I'm one of those that wasn't really heard. The media, I know the way it was, things were reported. NPR is a good example. I listened to NPR more than anything else and felt that it wasn't, the voice that wasn't heard from people like me. It was usually more liberal and that sort of thing. So mm-hmm. I wanted to hear more of that because I wanted that message to get out. It wasn't fair. So I felt like we were neglected, weren't hearing it. And I thought the reason Trump might get elected, because I voted for him, is that because it wasn't being reported. Everything was going towards Hillary. And I thought, gosh, there's a lot of people out here who feel like me.
But what about the policies specifically that you heard from Donald Trump on the campaign trail? What really made you think he's the right person to lead the country?
I have to admit that I think Hillary, from a background standpoint, had a lot more going for her. But
so was this a protest vote, Mike?
In a way, it's a protest vote because I probably would have voted Libertarian, except that I didn't feel the Libertarian candidate was going to make it, and I voted a bit for Hillary. But there was a point in time early on where I wasn't sure where I was going to go with it, and Hillary was in my sights. And so I moved more. I tend to be more conservative, but I was wavering. I'm registered independent, I think I said.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, there's a little bit of a protest vote. I didn't feel that I was hearing enough solid stuff from Donald Trump, but I felt, I guess I went with a lot of his business instincts. I'm a businessman, was mm-hmm. a businessman, and I felt that that was what I was looking for. I'm very frustrated. I was frustrated with everybody.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I felt that having said that, that was a vote for Donald Trump not being part of the establishment because I could not find a candidate that I really wanted to get behind. And so I chose him because I thought he stood a better chance of being an outsider.
Mike, we appreciate the phone call. Scott Arsenault, the executive director of the Florida Democratic Party. Some of the Trump support that he did find in South Florida, some of those supporters like Mike and others I've spoken to over the past 96 hours or so, have talked about it was a vote against the system, the Trump vote. The Trump vote was a vote against up to a generation or so of the political class. And Hillary Clinton just happened to be the Democratic side of that counter vote. How does the Democratic Party hear that now?
Well, look, I agree. I mean, there's a lot of anger out there, and I don't think we did a good enough job of realizing that, that folks are angry. I think more importantly, there's a lot of fear. People are worried, they're scared, they need to meet their mortgage, they have to pay their bills. They wonder what's going to come next. And I don't think we did not tap into that enough. I don't think we acknowledged that anger, but more importantly, that fear that people are feeling.
Yeah.
Throughout this campaign, and we need to understand that, I think, as Democrats, and build on this and figure out how we can do better.
Talking now with the executive director of the Florida Democratic Party, Scott Arsenault. We earlier spoke with the chair of the Florida Republican Party. You can join the conversation statewide, the Peninsula to the Panhandle, 305-995-1800. You are listening to Decision Florida from WLRN Miami. This is Florida Public Radio.
And going to take another call now. We've got Daniel calling in from Sarasota. Daniel, you're on the air. How did you vote and why?
Hi, sure. So I did vote for Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary, and quite to the opposite of the point that your guest made, I did flip the ticket. I voted Donald Trump at the top of the ticket and down, more or less, down the ballot, Democratic.
So you're one of those people that Donald Trump spoke to and said, what have you got to lose? You know, come on over, those Bernie Sanders supporters, come on over to the Trump ticket. You're actually one of the people he reached out to and managed to convince.
Certainly. And I would like to repudiate the point your guest made specifically in the beginning that he did not think people were voting specifically against the establishment, and also that he did not think people would be splitting the ticket. So it was kind of a perfect storm, supporting Bernie in the primaries. I think, despite what the media might say, people on the ground floor did see that there was actions against Bernie Sanders in the primary by the establishment repeatedly that were not even acknowledged. Debbie Wasserman Schultz stepped down and was immediately appointed to Hillary Clinton's campaign. Now we have Donna Brazile as the chair of the DNC, who was also implicated in these helping Hillary Clinton in the primary. And really just what I want to say is now I'm hearing from some Democratic operatives that they're talking about Tim Kaine and Andrew Cuomo as the 2020 frontrunners. That's getting everything completely wrong.
Yeah. So I just want to mark it. 53 minutes, 50 seconds into the program took us to mention 2020 for the next presidential campaign. So, Daniel, there you go. A raspberry to you from Sarasota. But nonetheless, let's put this, though, to Scott Arsenault in terms of some of the inner workings of the Democratic Party. You hear, you know, Daniel there and the Bernie Sanders supporters during the presidential primary were very put off by some of the inner workings of the Democratic National Committee, which, of course, led to Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz, a South Florida congresswoman, stepping down as the director of the national group. You know, a lot of inside politics there, but in terms of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, how do you begin to repair those relationships?
Well, clearly we've got some healing to do as Democrats. I think that your caller's anger there, I mentioned anger earlier, yeah. I could certainly see that and feel that. And I think that's another thing that we've got to acknowledge as Democrats, that we did not come together as much as we should have after the primary to bring those folks that were with Bernie Sanders in to acknowledge what their concerns again and what their fears were. And, you know, that's something that we've got to address going forward. And you will certainly not hear me mention 2020. I think we need to focus on the right now and what we need to do as Democrats to come together.
So does some of that, Scott Arsenault, look like kind of a cleaning of house? I mean, do you look at what the Democratic Party, rather, in Florida at least looks like and say we need to make some big changes sort of from the top down?
Well, I think, you know, I'm a big believer that you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think we need to look at kind of both what we did right and what we did wrong. I mentioned our strong ground game. I mean, we had a record vote and vote by mail. We had a record turnouts in Broward and Dade and Orange and other places. I mean, we need to look and see tactically what we were doing right to help all those things happen. I think we had a record performance among Hispanics here in Florida. That's a population that's going to continue to grow. But then I think obviously what I mentioned that we did wrong, and those places in Florida that we did not get to, which where we did worse. Why did we do worse, and then how did we do better?
Blazingolia, the chair of the Florida Republican Party, said Florida is not a purple state, a red state that lost the last two presidential elections. It certainly turned red on the electoral map on Tuesday. Tell us, Scott, what that road is ahead for the Florida Democratic Party, especially as it relates to local legislators.
Sure. Well, first I would dispute that strongly. I mean, we were clearly a purple state. We were clearly a swing state. I mean, Donald Trump got 49%. Okay, he didn't need not even break 50%. Rick Scott has never broken 50%. To say that Republicans have a majority here is just not true.
Well, he didn't say Republicans have a majority, but Republican office holders.
He said it was a red. He said it was a red state.
The office holders. It was a red state because the office holders have a majority.
Sure. Yeah. So, I think this is clearly the quintessential swing state. Which means we've got to start battling out at both the local and the state level. And clearly, you know, I think we will begin to elect more Democrats as we grow. And I think we will continue to be a presidential battleground, I think, for years to come. And I think you're going to see Democrats picked up seats in the legislature this time, although just only a few. Mm-hmm. I think we'll continue to grow there and we'll continue to grow across the state.
Is the I-4 corridor, Scott Arsenault, still the kind of battleground of this battleground state, or do you look to other parts of the state in future elections to try and win some more voters over?
No, the I-4 remains the battleground. I mean, it was interesting this time in that we did much, much better in Orange County and Osceola County than we've done in the past, but we did much worse in Volusia County and Brevard, for example. I think it remains a battleground in Polk County and in Pasco and in Hillsborough and in Pinellas. So that will continue to remain. That is where the bulk of Florida's population is. Almost half the voters live there. That will continue to fight that out.
Scott Arsenault, Executive Director of the Florida Democratic Party. Thanks for spending so much time with us here today in Florida, on Decision Florida. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've got another hour to come on our special programming here, our post-election special from the peninsula to the panhandle. A lot of folks have said, Matthew, that people weren't listening to voters prior to Tuesday. So we want to hear from Floridians. What do you want Florida to know about the vote that you cast this week? Another hour of Decision Florida from Florida Public Radio and WLRN Public Media in Miami continues in just a moment. Stick with us.